Eat Drink Indie Radio is powered by eatdrinkindie.com. Eat local, drink local, eat drink indie. Welcome to Eat Drink Indie Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. I'm your host, Jolene Ketzenberger. Well, we are getting closer and closer to the end of 2016, and so it's a good time to look back on the past year, and that's what we're up to this week. We'll be revisiting some of my favorite interviews of this past year, ones that illustrate the depth and breadth of the local food scene here in central Indiana, from chefs to farmers to food artisans. First, because he and his restaurant continue to get so much national attention, we'll hear from Chef Jonathan Brooks of Milktooth about the incredible year that he and his staff have had. Then we'll look back a bit with Chef Tony Hanslitz and his wife Rosa about their experiences in the Indianapolis food scene over the past 30 years, since Tony was the opening chef of the acclaimed Peter's Restaurant that opened in Fountain Square in 1985. Since then, Tony has headed several restaurants, worked as the Dean of Culinary Education at the Chef's Academy here, and now focuses on Nicole Taylor's Pasta and Market with Rosa, where they offer a hugely popular dinner series, as well as lunch and events in their backroom eatery. And I just couldn't resist including one of my favorite interviews from this past year, with pastry chef Cindy Hawkins of Circle City Sweets and the new Circle City Sweets Boulangerie in the Indianapolis City Market. Back in June, I caught up with Cindy while she was picking Juneberries, and we had a fun interview about the fruit and what she makes with it. We'll also hear about an ambitious effort on the part of Hancock County farmer Jonathan Lawler, who worked to combat hunger in central Indiana by raising fresh produce for food banks. I talked to Jonathan back in April, before the season started, about how and why he planned to help feed the hungry and tackle the problem of rural food deserts. And food entrepreneurs are also a big part of what's happening on the Indianapolis food scene. So many people had a great idea for a product and then just ran with it. From coffee to bacon to bread, these products fill a niche and their creators are nothing less than inspiring. An interview that I particularly enjoyed was with Haley McGinley, who launched Native Bread this past year and now sells her gluten-free artisan breads at farmers markets and through farmersmarket.com. So it has been an inspiring year here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio. So stay with us for more here on WFYI and WFYI.org. Well, here we are, almost to the end of 2016. And what a year it's been, right? But since it is almost over, it seems like a good time to look back on 2016 and all the people I've talked with here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio. It certainly was an incredible year for Indianapolis and our local food scene. It seems that 2016 was the year that the rest of the country noticed what we're up to here and discovered what we already know, that Indianapolis has a pretty great food scene going on. Back in May, Condé Nast Traveler included Indy in a story on places to visit and called us the most underrated food city in America, and later put Chef Jonathan Brooks's Milktooth restaurant on a list of the best restaurants in the world. We've also gotten attention from Zagat, Eater, Thrillist, and other websites, along with continuing recognition from Bon Appetit and Food & Wine magazines, who were early adopters and discovered us last year. And speaking of recognition, more of our chefs ended up on the James Beard Foundation's list of semi-finalists for their awards, and some of our chefs even cooked at the James Beard House in New York City. Here at home, it was a crazy busy year for new restaurant openings, with more downtown steakhouses, some out-of-state concepts that expanded into Indy, some popular chain restaurant openings, of course, but a surprising number of new local independent restaurants opened this past year as well. And the number of farmers markets grew. We saw lots of new food entrepreneurs enter the market. And here at Eat Drink Indy, we continue to grow as well. You'll hear some new segments next year, a few new regular voices, and you'll be able to keep up with what's going on with the new and improved eatdrinkindy.com website. So I know that I'm looking ahead to a better and brighter 2017, but until we get there, I've got a fun look back at some of my favorite interviews from this past year. When we talk about 2016, we just might remember it as the year that the world discovered Indianapolis and its food scene. Oh, 2015 was great and all, with attention from Bon Appetit and Food and Wine, but we garnered even more attention in 2016. But even now, Indianapolis continues to be surprised to find itself on all these food-related lists. But I'm here to tell you, Indianapolis, you deserve it. The city deserves the attention because our chefs and restaurateurs continue to raise the bar on local food and drink. We have top-notch talent and vibrant food neighborhoods with more restaurants opening all the time. But the restaurant that definitely captured the imagination of the national food press this past year was Milktooth. The restaurant that was launched just a little over 2 years ago by Jonathan Brooks and Ashley Brooks took off in such a big way and has just kept going. When Milktooth found itself on a list of best restaurants in the world this past fall, I stopped by to talk with chef owner Jonathan Brooks about all that attention and what it was like to find his restaurant on that list.
Absolutely complete and utter surprise to be so flattered by Condé Nast, and I'm overjoyed for the employees here and so proud of everybody that works at Milktooth, and I finally feel comfortable embracing that kind of praise instead of pushing it away.
Tell me about pushing it away. What do you mean?
You know, I mean, sometimes, you know, you feel squeamish about the attention, or you know, I certainly, when we got the Food and Wine Award and the Bon Appetit Award, I still had a little bit of, like, I felt uncomfortable about it to some degree. You know, I was certainly happy and proud of everyone at the restaurant, but me personally, I felt a little squeamish about it, and I don't feel that way anymore. And so that's kind of this is the first time I felt kind of, like, relieved and just, like, happy about something that big.
How does that happen? How do you get to that, to where it feels okay and good and exciting?
I mean, I think that I just don't put that kind of stuff up on a pedestal anymore, maybe. Because it has been within my reach for the last year, and I mean, it is what it is. It's an article, and it's very flattering, but it doesn't change what we do here, and I've seen that. You know, it changes in a good way the people that come into the restaurant, and we're exposed to more new guests, and that's exciting. But it hasn't changed anything about how we operate at Milktooth. And so it's comforting now to know that, I guess, because when the Food and Wine Award came out, I remember sitting and talking with Ashley when we were married then, and telling her that I didn't want to accept it because I was scared that it would change me and change the restaurant and change just our goals.
Were you really? Were you afraid?
We sat down in a bar and I was like, "Gosh, I'm not going to accept it. I don't."
Oh my gosh! Now how can you? I mean, there it is. It's just like this, you know, big thing from Food and Wine.
But I was just scared about it. I thought that we would get distracted and not remember what we wanted to do, and you know, that hasn't happened. And so it's a nice feeling now to be honored on a list such as the 200 best restaurants in the world, and just feel comfortable and happy about it, and know that it's not going to change what we do here. But
how are you confident that it's not going to change anymore compared to the first, you know, first few mentions in the national press?
For me, I mean, I'm sure lots of people maybe would never get comfortable with it, or some people would never be uncomfortable with it. But for me, you know, my backbone is just coming to work every day and, like, doing what I love with people that I love, and just having a really good time and making people happy. And, like, yeah, I'm just able to feel happy about the praise instead of worrying about it. And also, like, we do 500 people here twice a week on the weekends. Like, I know that my staff can handle if there's an influx of people from the article. I'm totally confident that they can do it and not worried about it anymore.
Has it changed you personally, you know, all this attention? I mean, it's only been 2 years since Milktooth opened.
Yeah.
So have you changed over that time?
I don't know. I'm not an introspective person. I certainly, some days I feel worse than I ever have in my life before. I have aches and pains and things that weren't there before, but I don't know. I'm happier now than I've ever been in my life.
Are you really?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
What is it? Is it the fact that you got the restaurant open? And it did. It opened before you were 30.
Uh-huh.
So you got a restaurant open before you were 30, and incredible success. Is that it?
I don't know. Maybe after 2 years, I feel like it's less of a fluke. looking at numbers and like, all right, we're running a restaurant and we're not tanking this thing.
Did you think that? Was that a worry?
Absolutely. It was a huge worry. I was sleepless nights just worrying that everyone's going to lose their jobs because I was going to screw something up, or people would just stop coming because the food wasn't any good, or people hated me or something. But no, it feels great to be beyond that kind of, I guess, those naive fears that you can't do anything about anyway, and to just come to work today and have a good time, and that's all I care about.
So what are the goals now? I mean, you got your restaurant open. You got a lot of national press right away. You are among the top 10 restaurants in the country. And what's driving you?
I don't want to get bored. I want to keep challenging myself and growing and employing more people because I think I'm a good boss when it's all said and done. And just, you know, everyone here at Milk Tooth has gotten so much better at what they do since they've been here, as have I. And it's because we all, all the credit is not to me. We all push each other and challenge each other, and I'm so proud of that. I'm so proud that everybody here is growing and getting better, and that I am too. And I want to do that more and differently.
So more and different, more restaurants, different restaurants?
Yeah, I definitely have plans to open a new restaurant in 2017. And, you know, I have lots of pipe dreams in addition to that too.
Well, now I think they're not pipe dreams now. These are things that could happen. I mean, a lot of what this success has done is it brings opportunities with it. So where do you see Milk Tooth going?
Yeah, I mean, I'm never going to take my eyes off of what's going on at Milk Tooth. I mean, you know, we can afford to redesign and clean up the place and make things tighter and neater and prettier. And, you know, we're always getting better at what we do, hopefully. And so, you know, me moving on to another opportunity at a new restaurant just means that people here get to step up a little bit, as I know that they're chomping at the bit to do. I'll still be totally involved with the menu and the staff and being here all the time, but it's an opportunity that the people that work for me deserve. So I have to kind of like get out of the way at some point a little bit.
Now that's kind of interesting, because so much of Milk Tooth has revolved around you. You know, you got the attention, you've become, you know, the sort of a well-known chef. You know, you're traveling off to Aspen and, you know, food and wine events. So you getting out of the way, you know, is kind of interesting for what people see it as Milk Tooth. Is it gonna change that? I guess, are you Milk Tooth is the question.
I would say Milk Tooth is me. I'm not solely Milk Tooth. There's so many hardworking people here that have helped me along the way and that make me better. But that's just what people choose to focus on. I'm comfortable being the face because that's just, people are used to talking about the chef. And I do think the chef is absolutely the most important person in the restaurant. I think that's why Milk Tooth is so successful, is that all of the power was put into my hands. I'm not just someone's chef at their restaurant. All the power was put in my hands to get up, to be successful, either way it would go. And I think that's a huge part of why Milk Tooth is successful, is that I had that freedom to express myself with my restaurant in any way that I wanted to. And I think people do feed off of that, but it's not just me. You know, I need to be the force that drives that kind of mentality behind the restaurant, but I couldn't do anything alone.
We've been talking with Chef Jonathan Brooks of Milk Tooth. You can find out more about the restaurant at milktoothindy.com. Another of my favorite interviews from this past year was from last winter when I stopped in at Nicole Taylor's Pasta and Market to talk with Tona and Rosa Hanslet. Tony has been a constant on the Indianapolis restaurant scene since 1985, when he was executive chef at Peter's Restaurant in Fountain Square. He led other restaurants, including Tavola de Tosa that he and Rosa opened in 2000, and he later served as Dean of Culinary Education at the Chef's Academy. He and Rosa also host incredibly popular dinners in their shop's kitchen, dinners that are sold out a year in advance. But when the backroom eatery opened at the shop this past year, I stopped in to take a look back at the food scene in Indy and look ahead as well.
Well, I think there's a lot of young chefs and entrepreneurs that are now of age, and they've built a good career. I kind of remember those days. It's been a while, but I mean, there was just less of us, and I think there's more, and the chefs are training the next chefs. There's more places. You know, when we came here in 85, there was only a handful of places that you could go train at. So as those expanded, people were training and again and again, and I think now everybody's grown up, and they've earned their chops, and they found somebody to back them, and off we go.
Well, what was it like when you were doing that, when you were young, coming to town and opening a restaurant? Just kind of what was it like here?
Well, it's scary. I don't know. I think it just, there was just not that much competition. A lot of chains. Chains were coming in. I know when we opened Tavola a year after that, Maggiano's opened. There was just, it's just different. I mean, like, how many restaurants opened in 2015?
I lose count. I mean,
good ones,
right.
Yeah.
Good local,
yeah.
Independent
mm-hmm.
restaurants.
Yeah, I mean, good chefs, good restaurants. It just scares me that, the pie's only so big, and the piece is getting smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. And I've always thought, everybody works off a budget, and you have an entertainment budget. No matter where you spend that, if it's going to the movies and or bowling, that when that entertainment dollars are gone, then they're gone. So I remember Peter telling us one time, if you had three special events, birthday, anniversary, birthday, let's say, and you had six favorite restaurants to celebrate those three, I wouldn't see you for 2 years. So you cannot be a special occasion restaurant. That stuck with me forever. So what we're trying to accomplish here is, like Rosa said, just come in, enjoy food, enjoy your company, more of a, I don't want to say coffee house because we're not far from a coffee house, but that comfortable, relaxing feeling that you're here to enjoy the people you're here with. We'll do our best to give you the best quality of food that we can and make it homey and just have some fun.
How have consumers changed?
Educated, much more educated. They want to know where their food's coming from, where it's sourced. There's been a lot of controversy and again, eating local. So you just have to spend more time sourcing your food, getting to meet your growers so you can tell what the consumer is. To tell the consumer where you're getting your product from. I'm working with some people to get our meat and poultry from that could literally tell you from birth to butcher to slaughter what that animal's been fed and where the feed came from. It's just really, that's where it's gotten, which is a good thing.
What about the restaurant climate? We've had some high-profile closings. David Talent in Bloomington closed Restaurant Talent. Regina Mihalik has just recently announced that she's going to close our bistro. Is that significant? Is it just the life cycle, or are we seeing something happening here?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. I think you know, kind of, I don't want to compare Regina and I, but I'm moving on to something new in my life. She's moving on to something that she's created and that's new in her life. And maybe it's just time to concentrate on something new.
To do something new, is it easier to close something and then do something new?
Oh, see, I was forced to close. She's going out on top. So I don't have that feeling. you know, it's your life. I know she's going to go from, you know, right around the corner, but it'll never be the same driving down Massachusetts Avenue, not for the consumer. I could imagine how it would be for her.
See, that's interesting, you know, for the consumer, you know, that, you know, we get attached to things, I think, you know, and so then when it changes, you know, we think, oh, you know, that's, you know, oh, it's so sad, but maybe it's not sad. Maybe they're, you know, maybe it's exciting, you know, to see what comes next, you know, as people reinvent themselves.
Exactly. I mean, she's not going away by any stretch. She still has a kitchen. She'll never lose her skill. She's a great chef. So she's not going away. She's just doing it on her terms.
Is this an evolution that we're seeing? Because I'm starting to see some trends here, you know, with people perhaps wanting classes, you know, like you're going to be doing, a sort of casual atmosphere, you know. Is there, you know, has dining changed significantly? Maybe that's what we're seeing.
Well, maybe, I don't know if it's dining as much as it is maybe society. I saw a Goodwill commercial the other day where they had a suit on a hanger and it said casual Fridays are gone, and you know, now everything's casual and they don't need the suit anymore. Maybe that's just our society, that, you know, which is not a bad thing, you know, to relax and breathe and enjoy company. Food brings, as Rosa said, food brings people together. So we just have to offer that space. I just think people they need to eat at home. I should say this, they need to eat at home and be a family. And if they can't, you know, be somewhere as a family, you know, it's the old soul food thing. You know, they did Sundays. We're just offering Sundays 5 days, 6 days a week, 5 days a week. So,
but the quality of the food is probably even better than it has ever been.
If you don't have quality, they're not going to support you. They can cook at home. They can get these things. They go to the farmer's market. A chef will go to the farmer's market and stand right next to one of their customers buying the same beets because they know how to cook them that you're going to serve in the restaurant that night, because if you're sourcing local like that during farmer's markets time. So it just... People want to know where their food's coming from. You know, less mass produced, tastes better. We watched Chef's Table, where, you know, literally the guy grows everything. It was unbelievable. And just like he said, I've never tasted radish that tastes like this. That sticks with me. So I think that, you know, and everybody's that way, you know. It's like, oh my gosh, I could, you know, the tomatoes in August are like not like they will be in May, you know, the ones they're planting now or last couple weeks ago that we'll have in May. They'll be nice, but they won't be August, September.
Are you optimistic about the local food scene and where we're going as a city?
There's a lot of great food out there. It's great for us as consumers because we close at 7.
We've been talking with Tony and Rosa Hanslitz of Nicole Taylor's Pasta and Market and Backroom Eatery. For more information, go to NicoleTaylorsPasta.com. There were so many interviews from this past year that I enjoyed, but one that took place under a tree on the Butler University campus just had to make the list. It was there, under a tree full of little berries, that I talked with pastry chef Cindy Hawkins about Juneberries. Now, I had seen her popular Juneberry jam at her shop, Circle City Sweets, at the Indianapolis City Market and at farmers markets, but I was never really sure just what a Juneberry was until I stopped by her favorite trees at Butler University, her alma mater. Cindy explained to me just what a Juneberry is, what she does with them, and why she gets so excited about the short Juneberry season.
they're really called service berries, but their nickname are June berries just because they're, I think, because they come out really the 1st of June.
So are they just like right here in front of us, like under my nose, and I just don't notice them?
They're everywhere. I mean, people, it's amazing to me how many people, when at the farmer's market, if they see the jam, they'll ask me about it. And I'll explain to them what the trees are and what they look like. And I cannot tell you how many people say, I think I have one of those in my yard. And I'm like, do the birds go crazy for them? Like the beginning of June? Like, yes. I'm like, you have one in your yard. But they're a great ornamental tree. Again, if you have it on your sidewalk or somewhere like that, it's going to be messy because eventually, I mean, look at how many have dropped here in the pathway at Butler where we're at. You know, and then people are tracking that everywhere. And so some people don't want to have them on their property, but they're a great ornamental tree. They bring a lot of birds and, you know, like I said, the birds go nuts for the berries. So
and
I have to beat the birds here to pick them.
And they must make good jam. So tell me about your jam.
Yeah, the jam is, it's again, it's just really kind of hard to describe because, you know, the fruit changes a little bit in flavor, I think, every year based on the weather. And like I said, I can't wait to see how this batch turns out. We make it the exact same every year. It's you know, we do 80% sugar and a juice of one lemon for every 1,000 grams of fruit. And I cook it the exact same way every year. And every year it's different. Every year it's different. And then we'll put it with different things. I just picked up some awesome tart cherries yesterday at the market. So I'm going to get those pitted and ready tonight. So then I like to do a Juneberry cherry jam. It's a nice little combination, the two of them. Tracy at Cerulean was talking to me yesterday about, she's got some service berries that she's been picking at Ellenberger Park. And she's going to do, she works at Cerulean, she's going to do a pasta special with it. And I said, you have to send me a picture of it. I'm dying to see what it looks like. So she was going to work with that. And she just discovered them recently, too. Someone had told her about them.
Now, how do you describe the flavor? What are they like anything?
I lean a lot to say that they're kind of like a blueberry, but they're not. It's such a hard flavor to describe. The texture of them is, I think, a little bit juicier than a blueberry. It's not quite as meaty as a blueberry would be. And there's one kind of larger seed in the center, but it's a nice soft seed. I don't take it out of my jams. I don't, you know, that's what helps give the pectin. So I don't take it out when I make jam. And I just eat the seeds. It's no big deal. They're nice and soft and small, but kind of blueberry-ish, but not really. And
they kind of look like a blueberry.
They look a lot like a blueberry. I kind of describe them as they look like the blueberry. They've got the little star in the butt like a blueberry would, but they're on a stem like a cherry would be. So, you know, it was when the very first year I decided to make jam with them, I wasn't sure how to treat them. So I called Chef Jackie, or I emailed Chef Jackie up at French Pastry School, and I was like, hey, Chef Jackie, I've got this fruit, blah, blah, blah. And I figured he'd know, because, you know, he knows everything. And he goes, well, what's it look like? And I go, it looks like a blueberry. He goes, well, then treat it like a blueberry. I'm like, okay. And that's kind of what I've always done. So I make it like I would do a blueberry jam. I mean, when we did the pie, we did it like if we were making a blueberry pie with, you know, how to thicken it and stuff. And so I just always treated it in terms of preparation like a blueberry. So I'll be curious, like I said, I'll be curious to see what Tracy does with it over at Cerulean and see how she uses it.
But they're just here, like we're on the Butler University campus right now,
three,
and
four,
you can
five,
just
six, the other,
you
six
can just
them.
See them. I mean, the trees just
right, but
full
don't
of
come
them.
Pick them. These are mine. Don't come pick them. I paid a lot of tuition on this campus. These are mine. I'll have to beat you next year. No, there's a great customer of mine, and she and I both come over here and pick. And she'll, if I see her at the market or something, she'll say, I'm getting ready to go get my June berries. I'm like, don't pick them all. They're mine. But there's probably on campus, I bet there's probably 12 or 15 trees. You know, these eight that I like are over at Hinkle, and I don't know if it's just the way the shade hits. These are always really nice trees, and the ones on the east side of Hinkle are always really nice. The other ones through campus are a lot smaller, kind of scrawnier little trees. There's a couple in front of the residence college. There's a couple just in campus. There's one in front of one of the sorority houses.
And you said there's some at City Market that you
yeah we've
like
got two on
monitor?
The east plaza of City Market, so I kind of keep an eye on those to judge how ready they're getting. And those get a lot of sun. They're right on that east side, so they get full sun. So they go a little quicker, where this is on the west side of the building and it's got the shade of the building a little bit, I think. So these are usually maybe 4 or 5 days behind, a week behind the ones at City Market. I sent my nephew out to pick at the market on Tuesday, and he didn't get quite a full bowl, but he got a good amount. So I think he was nervous too, because someone yelled at him like, "You're not supposed to be up there," and he's like, "No, it's okay, really, I'm allowed." But yeah, they're like I said, they're all over town, and it's funny because I'll just be places. Oh, at the zoo, we were doing zooplation one year. We were walking through, and I'm sure people thought I was absolutely nuts because we're in our chef clothes and we're done with the event, and we're walking through, and I was like, oh, look, it's a Juneberry. And I reached up and I grabbed some and I pop it in my mouth. And these people are looking at me like I'm just some nut job. Like, don't you have real food? Someone like, no, these are, this is Juneberry. They're great. You should try them. And I'm like, oh. That's my favorite thing about doing it here on campus, picking on campus, is the number of people who will stop me. There was basketball camp going on last year, and a bunch of the coaches, after they were done, they were like, what are you doing? And so they were starting, you know, they were tasting. I'm like, man, those are so good. I'm like, all right, these are mine. You can taste, but you can't come pick. So
now, I think people are probably, you know, they don't trust themselves. They don't know what they are for sure, you know?
Yeah, don't just go find a tree that has berries and go, that must be a Juneberry, and start eating them. I don't want to, like, I'm not an expert on foraging. But there are, you know, there's great books out there that show you, like, what the leaves look like and what the berries look like. I'm probably pretty stupid because I have just walked up to trees and just be like, oh, those are Juneberries, and popped. And I think I've always been right, knock on tree limb. But, nothing's killed me yet.
And of course, this is the right time of year for them.
Oh, this is perfect. This is like the very end of May. Last year, we were on our trip to France, and as soon as we got home, I was like, oh no, the Juneberries. And I hurried around to campus, and they were not quite ready yet, so I was good. But yeah, really, honestly, it's like that very last few days of May, you know, right after Memorial Day, right up to the first week of June. This is probably like the tail end of these. They, you know, there's probably some pockets of ones that would be good. And, you know, like those, you can kind of see these up here a little bit redder. So those would probably be good in a couple of days, but the majority of them, you're kind of seeing that they're getting a lot darker. And then the ones you don't want are like when you see some that look almost like they've dehydrated a little bit, that the sugars are kind of, the moisture's going away, and they're a little puckered. I try not to pick those.
But they do make good jam, right?
Oh, they make great jam. This guy hired us a couple years ago to make him a pie. He said his grandma always made Juneberry pie. And like I said, I'd never heard of him. It's not a fruit I grew up with, and
I didn't either. I didn't grow up seeing them, you know.
But you probably did. You just didn't know it.
That's the thing.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what's so funny about it is I'm sure 90% of the people who live here have either they know someone has one in their yard or they've walked past a tree, whatever, and you just assume they're not an edible fruit. But they are
so, because it's just plentiful. Yeah. I mean, and the tree's not too big. It's not like a big, tall tree that you can't reach.
No, I if I bring anything, I bring a little step stool with me, and, you know, I'd say they're probably an ornamental tree, you know. But man, they've got good fruit.
We've been talking with pastry chef Cindy Hawkins of Circle City Sweets, and now Circle City Sweets Boulangerie in the Indianapolis City Market. You can find out more at circlecitysweets.com. Sometimes when I talk to people about a project, I have to wonder if an idea will really work, if someone can take their big idea and really make it happen. I have to admit that I wasn't sure if Jonathan Lawler, a Hancock County farmer, would be able to make his big idea a reality, but he did. I talked with Jonathan last spring, before any fields had been planted, about his idea to combat hunger in rural food deserts by raising produce for food banks in central Indiana. Lawler started Brandywine Creek Farms last year, invited the public out to the farm to help plant the first crops of the season, and the public responded. Brandywine Creek Farms partnered with Gleaners Food Bank, Kenneth Butler Memorial Soup Kitchen, and the Flanner House of Indianapolis, and Hancock Regional Hospital sponsored the 2016 growing season, and it was definitely a success. Brandywine Creek Farms raised approximately 411,000 pounds of produce, 211 tons, and next year he hopes to raise 1 million pounds. I talked with Jonathan back in the spring about how the idea for Brandywine Creek Farms and its effort to combat hunger came about.
My son said that there was kids taking food home from the food pantry, and if you leave my farm and drive there, it's nothing but farms.
All around us.
All around us. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So I thought, well, maybe I can make a difference, and I talked to the soup kitchen here, and they told me that they couldn't get produce, or that it was very difficult to get. And then talked to Gleaners Food Bank, Midwest Food Bank. Produce was their number one thing they could not get. Then I started talking to the township trustees about teenagers coming in and asking for food. And they would love to be able to give them good stuff, but they're giving them boxed food and canned food. And I decided we were going to just like plant like a couple acres, but we decided to just turn the whole farm into feeding people with local food.
Now, how can you do that? I mean, the farm, I'm sure, is you know, part of your job. You know, you support your own family.
Well, I mean, I've been able to finance it off of my transportation. I have a transportation marketing firm. I had, when I first started getting into it, I had a couple of gentlemen approach me and talk to me about starting a nonprofit that just wasn't for donating food, but to also bring people out to the farm and teach them how to grow their own food. We just actually just had a new guy join our board, and he, his name is Gabe Nix. He is our military outreach, to bring military vets in to teach them how to farm. And not only that, we plan on standing them up on their own acreage next year. So that's...
So you have a not-for-profit set up already?
Yeah, it's in the process. I tell you what, I don't think I've ever done anything as hard as a not-for-profit. I mean, it just amazes me how much of a business it truly is. That's not what we're about. We're about feeding people. We've had, you know, Richard Petty actually reached out to us, and he's putting on a fundraiser for us in July. Ruth Chris Steakhouse is putting on a fundraiser for us this fall, and we're doing a farm-to-table dinner and auction. So, you know, that, and we're also going to start looking really hard at ag grants, because, you know, a lot of those dollars can go other places. Not only that, we will sell a small percentage of the produce, and that's already going to a couple local restaurants.
Well, now, I'm sure people wonder, you know, what's the catch? You know, what's in it for you? Why are you doing it?
What's in it for me? Well, yeah, I had a professor from Ohio State University, like, call me out on Facebook and said that I'm probably swimming in donation dollars right now. He is more than welcome to come here and see that we really aren't. I have made the least amount of money I've ever made in my life doing this. In the last, you know, from the day I decided to do it, all the research, everything, I've had more joy than I've ever had in my life as well. So, you know, there's no, I mean, maybe that's the catch. I just want to feel good about myself. I don't know.
Now, when did it start? When did you make that decision to do this?
It was in the fall when my son told me about that, you know, and me and my wife talked, and we were just, like I said, we were looking at just going to plant a couple acres, maybe 2 or 3 acres, and we just started researching all the hunger. And, you know, when Jill told me, well, you know, if you bring in too much, you know, we want other places to go. So I thought, well, maybe I'll talk to gleaners. And I talked to a gentleman that was volunteering there, and he was like, how much do you think you could raise if you, you know, really tried? And I thought about that, and I kept hearing that 135,000 people were food insecure. And I thought, well, that's when I told my wife, and that was like in November. I said, let's just make the whole farm grow for the hungry. You know, I think we can finance it. And I've talked to a couple guys who said that we should maybe go that direction. They can help with a nonprofit. And that's when we went for it.
So the idea for raising fresh produce to help feed the hungry and the food insecure, how did that idea progress?
Well, it was just, without getting too political, it makes me mad that Indiana could feed the United States 3 times over. But what do we grow in fields now? Ethanol, soy diesel, boxes of macaroni and cheese. Not only that, I mean, I decided, you know, I'm tired of having to put on the front, even though I live in a county where, you know, it's very conventional. And, you know, I decided that, you know, I'm going to show the environmental aspect of taking care of the land. The, you know, the ability that we do have the ability to feed our own, our community. I'm so sick and tired of hearing American farmers have to feed the world. That drives me nuts. You know, we're trying to feed the world, and we have people, 135,000 people in Indianapolis that are food insecure. You know, that just does not make any sense to me. You know, and I don't have all the answers. On the produce side, I think I do.
So you have some answers to the problem of getting fresh produce to people who want it.
The state of Indiana used to be a produce powerhouse. And unfortunately, now it's everything's commodity farming. And that's not the farmer's fault by any stretch. I mean, they're under the same broken food system that we all are. You know, they're doing what they need to do to make a living, and they're some of the hardest working guys I know, and gals, you know. So it's not about that. It's about us being able to give people, you know, real food, you know. I used to be one of those people that I believe that someone who was hungry lived in a bridge under Indianapolis. There was no hunger in my county. And, you know, I found out that I'm wrong. I would see kids who were overweight at a soup kitchen or at Gleaners and go, what is he doing there? He doesn't need that food. And again, after speaking to doctors, I was very wrong, you know, and I won't make those mistakes again. Food deserts aren't just in cities. They're out here, too.
That's a very interesting point, and I don't think that's one that people think about very often.
Right. If you take somebody that lives in one of these small towns, they don't have transportation, their food choices are Dollar General or gas station. And I don't know if you've seen the produce in Dollar General. It's junk, and it's expensive. And that's just not something that works for us. We need to make sure that those people have access to produce, just like the people in the city have access to it. My hope in all this is that more farmers get involved. And, you know, it's time that we step up. I think it's great what people do with the community gardens and stuff. It's time we step up, start using our tractors, our innovation, our machinery to start, you know, stop planting. I mean, not that I'm saying to stop planting commodity corn, but we can plant just as much sweet corn to feed people. We can plant green beans just like we do soybeans, you know. I mean, we can plant real food that you can walk into the fields and eat. That's what we need to do, and it's just not happening.
We've been talking with Jonathan Lawler of Brandywine Creek Farms in Hancock County. To find out more, go to brandywinecreekfarms.org. We talk to a lot of food artisans here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio, and I find them all inspiring. I love how entrepreneurs see a niche, discover a passion, and run with it. I've talked to so many food entrepreneurs over the past 2 years, so I just had to include a story of a local food artisan in my look back at 2016. And this one is really a great story. Indianapolis resident Haley McGinley was shopping at the farmer's market last winter when she realized that what she really wanted was a great loaf of gluten-free artisan bread. Unfortunately, she couldn't find anyone making the kind of crunchy, crusty bread that she had in mind. So she started making it herself. Haley launched Native Bread last summer and has quickly grown the effort into a business. You can find her breads now at some local shops and restaurants and through farmersmarket.com. I talked with Haley this past fall to find out how it all started.
Yeah, so literally I was at the farmer's market, and it was actually the Broad Ripple Winter Market. And I really was craving some bread. There's great local bakers. There's Amelia's and Renee's Bakery. However, they don't make gluten-free bread. And I just had the thought one day that I really wished Indianapolis had a high-quality gluten-free artisan bakery. And I said to myself, well, I can wait for someone else to do that, or I can do it myself.
Now that is so cool. So, but now tell me about your background, and whether, I mean, do you have any sort of baking background?
No, I don't. And that really held me up for a while, in terms of like whether I should do this or not. And I talked to my friends about it, and I said, you know, this is crazy. I have no experience. I never even made a gluten-free artisan bread in my life. I've baked a ton, but not gluten-free artisan bread. And everyone was just like, you know what, Haley, it doesn't matter. You can learn. And there's so many people out there and so many businesses that have been started by people who they didn't know what they were doing in the beginning, but you learn as you go. And I'm a fast learner too. So I'm just self-taught from the library and food blogs online.
So this is what you eat, though. So you were looking for this because it's what you want in your own diet, right?
Right. Yeah. I'm very particular with my diet. So I wanted to create a product that I felt good eating, and that I could feel proud to serve to the community as well.
Now, how does that start? How do you go about coming up with the kind of artisan bread that you were looking for?
Well, I started with breads that I would want to eat. I was like, what are my favorite kind of breads? And I went from there, and my favorite kind of breads are those really, like, dense, full of, like, the crunchy seeds and whole grains and things like that, like the darker, richer breads. But then I also have a sweet tooth, and I love sweet things, so I don't have it right now, but down the road I'm going to do, like, cinnamon buns and a cinnamon raisin loaf and scones and different baked goods like that. And then I also have sourdough and a honey. So the honey oat loaf sort of satisfies that sweet tooth. And then the sourdough, I mean, everybody loves a good sourdough. And nobody's doing a gluten-free sourdough, so.
So what was the first thing that you made, and how did it come out?
First thing I made, I made a boule. It was just like a basic sort of like a whole grain boule, and then that evolved into what I currently make, the seeded whole grain boule. And in the beginning, you know, I failed quite a bit, or I don't call it failures. You don't fail, you just get results, and then you learn from
them. How did the first ones come out? I mean, had you baked with, you said you hadn't done any gluten-free baking before,
right? I'm trying to remember. Like, I'm a visual person. I'm trying to picture. I mean, in the beginning, and even now, you know, I'll create a recipe and it doesn't come out quite right, and I just tweak it and change things here and there until it's where I want it to be. But yeah, definitely in the beginning, just they were not coming out great.
How did you tweak it? I mean, did you start out, like, basing it on recipes from here and there?
Yeah, I love food blogs. I've been hugely into food blogs for years once I got on this, like, healthy eating kind of lifestyle. So I definitely utilized the internet and food blogs quite a bit. And then I would go to the library and just check out, like, 10 books at a time. I also bought a whole bunch of books from halfpricebooks.com. And I found recipes that sort of fit the bill of what I was looking for, that, you know, used more whole grains, not as much starch, were dairy-free. But it was really challenging to find recipes that already existed that were dairy-free and soy-free and egg-free and all these things. So I had to take these recipes and then just substitute, you know, instead of using eggs, using egg replacers like a flax meal and things like that.
So these breads are not only gluten-free, but they're vegan as well?
Yes.
Oh my gosh, now you set yourself up for a big challenge in trying to do all this, you know?
Yeah, I know, definitely.
So you did kind of set yourself up for a challenge in trying to do this, right? So now tell me about what some of the requirements for the bread, because you just aren't looking for the easy gluten-free bread. You want it to be, you know, to have a lot of good things in it too, right?
Right, yeah. I want it to be, like I was saying earlier, something that I feel good eating and that I'm proud to give people as well. I wanted the breads to be dairy-free and soy-free and egg-free, and I don't use nuts either. Just really friendly for people that have all different types of allergies, you know, food allergies.
I bet that was hard, you know, creating those recipes.
It was. It was a challenge, but I feel like now I've nailed down the recipes for the breads that I have, and so from there it's easier to create new ones. But, you know, definitely I learn from the quote-unquote fails, the results, and but it's just fun. I love a challenge, and like I said, I'm a fast learner, so if I make a mistake, I learn from that mistake, and I can, you know, move forward, and it'll be way better even the second time I do it.
So now what are you envisioning down the road? I mean, are you hoping to expand the lineup and sell to restaurants? And, well, where do you see it going?
Yes to all of the above. So when I first had this vision, that's exactly what it was. It was this grand vision of native bread being accessible nationwide. And however, I'm a local, you know, person. I love supporting local and eating local, shopping local, all those things. So, and I love Indianapolis. So my, you know, initially my goal is to really make a name for myself in Indy and just get in as many local restaurants as I can and local grocery stores, and then just expand from there. And yeah, I've just always envisioned it growing and expanding so that I can help and provide the spread to as many people as I can, I guess. And I'm right now at the Garden Table in Broad Ripple, and also online at farmersmarket.com. So people can order online there. And farmersmarket.com is great because they will either deliver it straight to your door, or they have like close to 30 different locations around the city, so you can just find the location that's closest to you and go pick it up, and there's no delivery fee if you do it that way.
We've been talking with Haley McGinley of Native Bread. To find out more, go to nativebread.com. This is Jolene Ketzenberger, and you've been listening to Eat, Drink, and Do Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. We've been looking back at some of my favorite interviews of this past year, so thank you so much for tuning in and looking back at 2016 along with me. Thank you as well to our guests this week, Chef Jonathan Brooks of Milktooth, Chef Tony Hanslitz and Rosa Hanslitz of Nicole Taylor's Pasta and Market and Backroom Eatery, pastry chef Cindy Hawkins of Circle City Sweets and Circle City Sweets Boulangerie, farmer Jonathan Lawler of Brandywine Creek Farms, and Haley McGinley of Native Bread. And thanks also to producer John Ketzenberger for helping to bring you Eat, Drink, and Do Radio.